It's the Burt Cohen Show. Tax time. April 15th was tax time. Everybody loves it, right? Well, maybe not. But Oliver Wendell Holmes, a great U.S. Supreme Court justice, a long time ago said, taxes are what we pay for a civilized society. Shocking. Everyone doesn't always agree with that. There's a lot of people, frankly, who hate taxes, who hate where the money goes. It comes from our pocket to, well, where? We're going to talk about our taxes, where they go, today on the Burt Cohen Show. Today, our guest is Mattia Kramer. Mattia, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Mattia Kramer leads the National Priorities Projects Research Program, covering such topics as the federal budget process, federal spending and tax policy, federal health care programs, Social Security, military and Homeland Security funding, and debt and deficit. Mattia is the lead author of National Priorities Project's book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, and she serves as a regular commentator for media outlets across the country. Her writing has been published in places such as The Washington Post, The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, Mother Jones, Al Jazeera, CBS News. Thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. People see money going from their pocket to who knows where. Is there an easy way we can find out where the money goes?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. What we do at National Priorities Project is we try to take the federal budget and federal spending, which is, of course, a very complex subject, and to turn it into something that's transparent and accessible. So in honor of Tax Day, we put out Tax Day 2013, which in very simple terms shows where each one of your federal income tax dollars goes down to the penny. So a simple glance at it, and you'll know that far from sending a check into a black hole, which is often what it feels like when you right. file your federal income taxes, you can see instead exactly where that money goes.
Well, that's a good thing. And it's interesting. I can get the information from the National Priorities Project and looked at the White House webpage, and there are some slight differences as to where the money goes. Now, a lot of people have a sense that a huge portion goes to what is called national defense, military spending, the war budget, what have you. The White House says about 25%. You guys are 26.5%. But does that cover other war-related spending? Isn't there a lot of spending for military endeavors that is not on that particular book?
So the vast majority of that chunk, and according to our calculations at National Priorities Project, about 26.5 cents on every income tax dollar goes to the military. The vast majority of that is the Department of Defense base budget, uh-huh. and that's certainly included in the White House national defense category as well. So we have we're very close to the same number in that regard because we both include that huge chunk of spending that goes to the Department of Defense. There are some other pieces in there that are not exactly just the Department of Defense base budget. For instance, war funding is right. not included in the Pentagon's base budget, although certainly the White House and our tax numbers as well include war costs as part of that military category.
Uh-huh.
A couple other things as well. There's nuclear weapons costs, and those occur at the Department of Energy.
Right.
So it's not necessarily the case that the White House included that in their total national defense category, and then also international or foreign military assistance. That's something that sometimes you could group with international affairs or foreign aid. But for a national priorities project, we include that in the total cost of military in terms of where your taxes go.
So then is it fair to say that there is the, you know, official Pentagon budget, and then there's, you know, off, well, not off the books, but other spending for the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, wherever. But that the bottom line is, out of every dollar that you send the federal government, including that stuff, it's still about 26.5 cents out of each dollar?
That's correct. What that does not include is homeland security, and some people might be inclined to include that in a sort of national defense or security category. Homeland security, though, is a complicated issue, in part because of the way it's funded, and there's homeland security funding at just about every federal agency, and so all of the homeland security funding is not included in that military category, but rather is spread out across all of the other areas of the budget.
Uh-huh. Well, if you just tuned in, Burt Cohen Show, we're talking about taxes. April 15th is that day, oh, everybody loves when people pay their taxes. Is there a way to know what Americans actually want their tax dollars to be spent on? I mean, there are decisions made as to how the money is expended. How can we find out what Americans really want their tax dollars to go to?
Well, since our mission at National Priorities Project is to make the federal budget something that's accessible to regular people and then allows people to influence Washington in order to make their own priorities known, we actually pay quite a bit of attention to opinion polls and any sort of temperature gauge that we can take on the sentiment of the American people. So we use great polling information from Gallup, for instance, or the Pew Charitable Trust, and also social science research in which social scientists gather, large groups of Americans. You know, it takes thousands of Americans to produce a statistically significant study, and ask people to juggle the federal budget priorities and decide where do they want to spend their tax dollars and how do they want tax dollars raised.
Uh-huh.
And so we do. There is great information out there to understand what are Americans' priorities. And what's interesting to me is, despite hearing all the time about what a polarized country we live in, there's actually quite a lot of agreement on some major areas. For instance, a strong majority of Americans want more funding for education, as one example, or job creation. And this is something overwhelmingly Americans say Washington ought to be focused on creating more jobs and boosting the economy. That's well over 90% of Americans agree on that issue.
Fascinating. In the past, was the actual spending more in line with popular will, or is this the gulf between what the public wants and what's actually spent on? Is this something relatively recent, or is it really traditional?
I think that it depends. I think there's been a little bit of both over time. You know, I think that, first of all, of course, sentiment, public opinion changes, and, you know, there's times when Americans are much more inclined to say that they want their tax dollars, for instance, to go largely to the military. You know, there's times when people feel that global threats warrant that.
Right.
We're not living in that moment right now. Americans, by and large, want to see fairly substantial reductions at the Department of Defense. And, you know, some folks have asked, in light of the attack on the Boston Marathon, you know, maybe we should be spending more on national defense. You know, maybe that requires that at this
right,
time.
Right.
But if you look at what we're spending money on at the Department of Defense, you know, we're investing huge amounts of money in Cold War weapons systems that are by and large not well suited to deal with the threats of the 21st century. So you think about what happened at Boston, stateless actor, or cybersecurity threats, certainly something new to the 21st century. The huge amounts of money that we spend at the Department of Defense in general are not well suited to the threats that we now face in this modern era. So that argument is not necessarily a good one.
Interesting that people say they want cuts in the military expenditure. I mean, many people, including myself, see massive military welfare. I mean, any kind of sense of the old welfare queens is nothing. I mean, that was largely a myth anyway, in comparison to the massive military welfare. And you cite a Gallup poll that indicates 58% of us favor major cuts in military and defense spending. Everybody,
it's quite an interesting figure.
Yeah, and people say they want to cut military spending, but then there's the NIMBY problem. Oh, my member of Congress wants to keep jobs here. And oftentimes, what passes for public works program here in the currently United States is military spending. You know, that's the only thing that we really, have a jobs program on. So how does that work out? People say they want to cut spending, but no, not in my backyard.
Oh, you're absolutely right. So the politics of the issue are much more difficult than simply looking at where general public opinion sentiment lies. The actual practice of it, if you were to go about making the kinds of cuts in military spending that Americans by and large support, you would run into exactly the problem that you're anticipating, which is that both legislators and the constituents in their districts would say, well, don't cut jobs in our district. That's right. That's a whole other issue. If we did undertake the kinds of cuts in military spending that Americans generally support, it would absolutely create some near-term pain and long-term pain for some people in certain segments of the population and certain geographies. There are ways of mitigating that,
sure.
But there's no way around the fact that it would mean job losses for some people.
And it's harder to talk long-term, I find, that people don't, like, for example, where this show originates, there's the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, which creates a lot of jobs there. A lot of people are working in metal trades, things like that. The reality is, at least in theory, those jobs could be changed to building, say, heavy industrial rail cars and things like that. It would take some time to transfer it. But nobody even wants to talk about that. We could be prepared to, as you say, mitigate some of the pain that would be caused to, frankly, some of the job losses building, these redundant weapon systems that are just good for absolutely nothing except creating jobs. Is there anybody talking about, not exactly conversion, but planning for the future, full use, strategic planning, it's been called?
Well, there are great think tanks, in particular in the D.C. area, that do work on that issue. For instance, what would the jobs of the 21st century be if we closed that shipyard? Could Portsmouth, New Hampshire be a cutting-edge leader in manufacturing solar panels, for instance? What is the industry of the future that those jobs could move to, and we could invest in worker training and ultimately transition from the kind of spending on no longer useful or now obsolete or problem-ridden
sure.
weapon systems
yeah.
to the kind of manufacturing that would be cutting edge and lay the groundwork for prosperity in the 21st century. So there are think tanks doing that work. Whether or not Washington is listening
sure.
Is a whole other question.
It is very hard to look long-term when you're looking at the next election breathing down your neck. Yeah, it's just, I don't know how things can change given that system there, the entrenched system. But that's the way we have it here. And while we're on the subject of military funding, which is a large portion, is it the largest? Well, is it the largest portion of the budget, largest percentage? Obviously, it's way less than 50%. But is it the largest chunk? It looks like it is.
Well, it's the largest share of our federal income taxes. But that's actually not the same thing as the total federal budget. And that's because our income taxes are only one of the kinds of taxes that we pay. If you look at your pay stub, you'll often see Medicare and Social Security itemized as separate kinds of taxes. That's a whole other sort of bucket of taxes separate from income taxes. If you group all of that together and look at the total federal budget, the military is not the largest share of the budget. Social Security and Medicare are larger than military spending. So at National Priorities Project, we group Social Security together with other income security programs such as unemployment, worker training, welfare, those sorts of programs. And together, that large Social Security and income security category comprises about a third of the federal budget, whereas military is about 18%. Healthcare comes in around a quarter of the total federal budget.
Interesting. On the staying on the subject of where cuts can be made. I mean, there is a lot of pressure to make cuts in spending. It seems like all the vogue to cut spending. And looking again at the military, there's a great amount of Cold War-oriented, clearly redundant and wasteful, obsolete weapon systems. And there's the relatively new F-35 Joint Strike Fighter that has already drained $84 billion from the U.S. Treasury and is projected to cost $1.5 trillion over its lifetime. And you hear it doesn't work. It just plain doesn't work. Is there any pressure to actually focus on some of these redundant, obsolete, wasteful spending systems? And if there is, follow up to that, I wonder how much we could save.
Oh, there is great research on this area about how much money we could save in the military budget without making us less safe, but making us safer by investing in the kind of technologies that will actually prepare us for 21st century threats. So great estimates suggest that we could easily cut about $1 trillion over a decade by making some major strategic and changes to the way that we conduct defense policy in this country. And that's, if you've heard of the sequestration, which is that budget term that refers to across-the-board spending cuts, if sequestration were to stay in effect for a decade, it would cut about $500 billion from military spending over the course of a decade. And I'm saying that we could cut twice that, $1 trillion, from military spending over a decade, and by making smart strategic changes in the way that we can conduct our military policy. So it's not a question of, will cuts make us less safe? It's would such cuts be conducted in a smart, strategic way?
And so many people, I think the knee-jerk reaction is, what, you can't cut defense spending? What are you, a traitor, unpatriotic? People who are really getting hurt, and my sense is paying too much of their percentage of taxes to these programs. These are the things that that they don't want to cut. It seems like, you've done looking at the numbers of how the public feels. The public still wants to cut defense, but my sense is, I wonder how many members of Congress would dare to talk about this. Certainly we've had Barney Frank in the past and a few others, and the research is there. But are these guys listening? Any reason to think they are?
Well, there has been a sea change on this lately, and you're certainly right to point out that it's been a political third rail for most lawmakers to even so much as suggest cuts to military spending. That's absolutely been the case. In recent months, with all the focus on debt and deficit in Washington, we've seen lawmakers come around to the notion that military spending should be on the table in terms of deficit reduction and long-term deficit reduction planning. And so that has been a bit of a sea change. But I will say, President Obama put out his budget proposal for 2014, not only did it not include these kinds of deep or strategic changes in military spending that would substantially contribute to deficit reduction, but he actually proposes canceling sequestration in 2014 and sparing the Department of Defense from most cuts. So he was proposing about a 1.5% cut from the Department of Defense in 2014, which is much smaller than that department is currently slated to be cut if sequestration stays in effect.
Yeah, we could talk about the military budget all day long. There's a lot of other parts of the budget. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, we're talking to Mattia Kramer about the National Priorities Project research into what Americans really want our tax dollars to go to. Is what the public wants in terms of creating jobs? You say your research indicates 99% of Americans want job creation bolstered, for example. Is it realistic what Americans want, or is it really an impossible demand?
Yeah, this is another area where I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a sense that Americans, want smaller deficits and less government spending, but that, they're unwilling to see any particular thing cut, and therefore that it's an impossible wish list. And in fact, if you actually look at the things that Americans overwhelmingly support, it's not an impossible wish list. We could do all of the things at once, and that's because Americans support some things that would and could dramatically contribute to deficit reduction. Reductions in military spending is one, but Americans also, by and large, support raising taxes on the wealthiest and on corporations, and that could contribute substantially to deficit reduction. Those different kinds of changes to long-term spending priorities could create the resources for investment in the areas that Americans want more spending in. So whether it's education or job creation, basically the wish list of Americans is doable. We could do all these things together. Americans also want to see less reliance on fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, carbon tax could do that by encouraging investment in renewable energy, and that would raise revenue. There's a lot of policy options out there that would map well to exactly what Americans want, and together could become a blueprint for actually deficit reduction and better fulfillment of Americans' priorities.
There's a lot to talk about there. When people want job creation, is there any data sense of, do they want the government to do it? Do they actually want government investment, actual direct job creation like FDR did, or do they really want the corporate world to do that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not aware of public opinion that addresses that particular issue, and you know, I think probably the truth is that in general, Americans don't know that they want their leaders in Washington to figure out the best way forward on that issue, and what they want to see is job creation on the ground.
Right.
Exactly how to get there, that should be left to our legislators, or you know, legislators in the private sector, or however the best way is to achieve it.
Yeah, my sense for a long time has been that, you know, back during the presidential campaign, when you know they said that Obama's stimulus was a waste of money. If there were real jobs out there that people saw, I think people would be thrilled. Democrats and Republicans, they just want to see their jobs. What about, you hear talk about offshore tax loopholes, the Cayman Islands, et cetera. Any guess as to how much offshore tax loopholes are costing us, and could they be closed realistically?
Well, I don't have the number specifically for offshore tax loopholes, but I will say that all tax loopholes, deductions, credits, everything, all of those kinds of deductions and credits in our tax code together are larger than our budget deficit. So if you can wrap your head around this concept, what I'm saying is the revenue that's lost to the U.S. Treasury, essentially, from all of these tax code complications or credits, deductions, however you want, loopholes, however you prefer to characterize them, is larger than the entire budget deficit. So if we wiped our tax code clean and just had the marginal tax rates as they currently exist, we wouldn't have run a deficit in 2012. And I think that that's wild for many people to think about. And certainly corporate tax loopholes play a role there, and actually individual tax loopholes, but things like the mortgage interest deduction, which is often derided for offering particular benefits to the wealthy for second and third homes and so forth. Those kinds of deductions are also very costly for the U.S. Treasury.
Well, but I think my guess would be that most people would like to maintain the deduction for first home mortgage interest. And, I you know, to see that as a tax loophole that should be eliminated, I think concerns an awful lot of people, myself. But for second and third homes, yeah, I don't think that would be too tough to sell. Isn't the whole idea behind tax breaks for the big corporations, the banks, and the wealthy to boost the economy by placing a value on certain things that allegedly help the economy?
This is a very tricky issue, right? So whether or not these tax loopholes, you know, obviously they were put into place ostensibly with some policy purpose at the
right.
outset, that they were meant to achieve something that was construed as a public good. Whether or not they're actually achieving those purposes is very unclear, and there's many tax experts who would say that no, it's not the case, that many of these loopholes don't serve any public interest purpose, and rather they're there because of lobbying, and once they're on the books in our tax code, it's very difficult to get rid of them.
And agribusiness subsidies, they came in to help farmers back in the Depression when they really, really needed help. But what about now? How much is that costing us? Is there a lot of waste there?
Well, you know, one person's waste is another person's income. I certainly wouldn't say waste directly. In 2013, we're spending around $140 billion on food and agriculture. You know, a large chunk of that goes to nutrition programs like food stamps and WIC, but a great deal of it also goes to subsidies to agricultural companies. And this is actually something that, not unlike, you know, the military, winds changing and lawmakers being willing to cut military spending or at least putting that on the table, food and agriculture subsidies to agricultural industries is something that's getting more and more attention. And the president included in his budget proposal put out last week some cuts to agricultural subsidies because they're no longer popular, and it's far from clear that they're achieving a public interest goal.
Those big expensive lobbyists are going to have to work a little harder to keep those in. I hope they do work hard because it's got to change. I mean, times change. We're not in the, you know, the Dust Bowl anymore. This is something else. And you say that most Americans do want expanded education funding. I wonder if you could paint a picture. What do people really want when it comes to early education, pre-K, through research universities? Do we really value education like we did in the 50s, you know, to bolster critical thinking and exercising our freedom as participating citizens? Or is it just, I don't know if your research shows, is it just a way to help people get jobs, which is obviously important, but what about the value of education? Can you read anything from your research?
Well, I think that Americans see it as investment, that when we put money into education, and whether it's pre-kindergarten education or higher ed or, you know, research universities, that we're getting something back from that, and that the return far exceeds the cost. And that's why I think that it's so popular, across opinion polls, across time, across political affiliation, that Americans want more money toward education because they view it as offering handsome returns down the road. And that was certainly the case, you know, in the 20th century. This country,
yes,
in large part, grew and enjoyed such prosperity because of our investments, which outmatched any of our international peers in education, primary and secondary education, and then a network of, you know, the best institutions of higher education in the world. But that was in the 20th century, and in the 21st century, our investment in education has declined as a share of total public spending, and it's not clear that we will stay, you know, on the outer edges of achievement in that area, even as Americans would like to see more money invested in education.
Yeah, I've heard it said that the only thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history. You look at the 50s, at the Eisenhower period, it was an amazing period of peace and prosperity. We really invested in education then. There was a very high tax rate on the upper income people, and we did well. But it seems like nobody wants to look at that. It worked. And, of course, Eisenhower, as we all know, warned us against the military-industrial complex, and he was certainly very, very right on that as well. But I guess we just don't want to see it. You know, for the most, it does seem that for most of the 20th century, our leaders understood the government's vital role in a healthy economy. Do they? What's the reality there?
Well, I wouldn't say that necessarily. You know, I think that there's been disagreement over time. It depends on what particular national or global challenge we're facing at the moment, and whether, you know, economists have yet to agree, far from it, on exactly what the government's optimal role in the economy is, or how best to grow the economy from the perspective of the public sector. You know, what are the implications for our legislators? It, you know, depends on the economist who you ask. I mean, there's certainly some evidence to suggest that raising, you know, you just mentioned higher marginal tax rates during the middle of the 20th century. That was certainly the case. Those tax rates were much higher,
yes,
than they are now. And, you know, cross economics research over time suggests that there are negatives to having higher tax rates, but that they're basically small. And I think that a survey of the economic literature would suggest that the negatives of having those higher tax rates are small relative to the potential benefits. But again, you know, so much disagreement among economists on how these things should inform policymaking.
Well, it does seem that most economists that I'm familiar with anyway recognize that, you know, government investment, actual stimulation, government participation in helping the economy absolutely helps. And it seems that at least many economists, if not most, insist that the deficit is not a problem, and that actually we should have more deficit spending, as in FDR's time, to boost the economy and to stimulate demand. But that doesn't seem to be happening right now.
Well, that's certainly true, and what makes this complicated is the difference between running deficits in the near term and reducing deficits in the long term. And I think that nuance has very much gotten lost in the discussion on debt and deficit in this country. There's been a lot of fear-mongering, a lot of misinformation on this subject. I think you're right that most economists would say that more deficit spending in the near term would boost the economy, create jobs, help to get us back to full employment or at least move in that direction, but that it's also important in the long term to reduce deficits, but that those are essentially separate or even unrelated issues. And we're instead of focusing on the near term and the economy, for the immediate future, we've brought deficit reduction into our near term plans and at the peril, essentially, of our economic growth.
So, am I hearing you right that the deficit problem in the moment is not really that big of a problem, but over long term, it could be, and that's something we need to pay attention for the long term. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Now, one reason that deficits aren't should not be our top concern right now is that interest rates are zero, essentially. The government can borrow money basically for free and use that money to for whatever your pet project or your preferred job creation or economy boosting measure, and then pay very little interest on borrowing money right now. What's the flip side of that is that interest rates will absolutely rise in the future, and that will hugely spike the borrowing costs and interest payments of our federal government. So what we don't want is to be in a situation down the road where the share that we're paying, share of our tax dollars going to interest on the federal debt balloons. We don't want to be in that scenario. So we want to borrow in the near term while it's very cheap to do so, and we can use that money to boost the economy and then down the road roll back deficits in order to contain our borrowing costs.
Yeah, it does seem that while the lending interest is just unbelievably low, now would be a good time to do that, I would think. And if you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, we're talking about where your tax dollars go, what the American priorities are, really, and perhaps Americans know their stuff and are really onto something here. And we're talking about, cutting the deficit. What interests are out there stoking the fire of this frenzy to cut the deficit and ramp up austerity, which is doing so much obvious damage to the European economy? How successfully has public opinion been manipulated by this? And again, what interests are behind that?
Well, there's definitely been a lot of fear-mongering on the debt and deficit issue. You know, we've heard statements like we're robbing our children's future, we have to cut spending now. At National Priorities Project, we follow public opinion sentiment, and so we're certainly sensitive to Americans wanting to, focus on deficit reduction and spending. But there's a tension there between, for instance, wanting to spend more on education and the notion that we should cut, for instance, Head Start funding in order to reduce near-term deficits. I think from the perspective of investing in our future, investing in education, something that Americans deeply support, I think that's frankly an absurd notion.
Clearly, and there's something called fix the debt, which seems to thankfully be kind of disappearing. It's the same old bunch of apparently greedy CEOs and corporations that they just have this self-serving interest and try to whip up the frenzy and seem like the middle, a third way, something like that. That they're trying to slash Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. But very, very controversial. President Barack Obama, a Democrat. I don't know how many people can still think of him as a liberal, actually. He's become the very first Democratic president ever to propose to lower Social Security benefits. Why is he doing that? What is the actual connection between Social Security and the deficit? And could there not be just minor tweaks to address any potential shortfalls?
Yes, absolutely. So this is something that we spend a lot of time talking about at National Priorities Project. Social Security does not face an immediate crisis. And to look at the news, you would not imagine that. You would think that the program is going bankrupt and we have to do something dramatic. That is not at all the case. The program can pay all scheduled benefits on its current pace, as currently projected, with no changes to the program for the next two decades. And after that, it can pay about 75% of all benefits through 2086. And now, in order to restore its full financial solvency through that time horizon and beyond, the program does just need minor tweaks, so changes to For instance, the way that we pay Social Security taxes. Most Americans don't know that the Social Security tax phases out on higher income levels. You only pay Social Security taxes on your first $113,000 of income. Most people don't know that, of course, because most of us do not reach that income threshold in our lives. And just by adjusting that tax formula, we could bring in substantial new revenue for the Social Security program, and that would not reduce benefits for those who are vulnerable.
So it's doable, and those Chicken Littles who say the sky is falling, there probably is some other motivation. Who is pushing? Where does this push for austerity come from? I mean, if it makes no sense at all, where is it coming from? And why does it have so much power? Is it just their big lobbyists that, you know, trump the feelings of the republic?
Well, the Fix the Debt campaign and many other campaigns around debt and deficit are in large part funded by a very wealthy person by the name of Pete Peterson, who has long been concerned with budget deficits even prior to, you know, the 2009 Great Recession and budget deficits that we've been running, the large deficits of recent years. This has long been an issue and an area of interest for him. But he's actually less concerned, to hear him talk about it, he's less concerned with near-term deficits than he is with the long-term horizon, and in particular containing health care costs, for instance, so that it doesn't break the bank. So I think that ultimately his interests, I mean, it's hard to know. You mentioned, you know, all the CEOs who have signed on with the Fix the Debt campaign. I certainly wouldn't pretend to know what motivates them in participating in that campaign. But Pete Peterson, who has funded many of these initiatives, is interested in the long-term deficit issue, which, as you and I just discussed, is the more pertinent issue as opposed to this driving focus on short-term deficits.
And, you know, one of the refrains we hear oftentimes is, and we hear it from the Tea Party people, you know, whose funding really does come from people like Peterson and top CEOs, corporate CEOs, this serves their interest. The common refrain is that the underclass, that for generations, has no intention of ever adding anything to society. The 47% that Mitt Romney talked about, and that they're takers and not makers. Compare the reality, if you would, of spending on that, the, you know, welfare to the underclass, whatever, to other areas of spending. How much do we really spend on that, and how big is that problem? I mean, the 47% obviously are not just takers, and they do try to contribute very much. It's, you know, rather a nasty swipe at them. But I wonder if you could talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a terribly misguided notion. I think there's no way even to answer that question with a particular number, because, you know, what would constitute the spending in that area is really in the eye of the beholder. The most costly programs are Social Security and Medicare, which mostly benefit senior citizens. And those are folks who have a great deal of political power, in large part, or certainly substantially vote Republican, or at least vote Republican as much as they vote Democrat, is my understanding. So the notion that those people are under attack, or, you know, takers instead of makers, or whatever the language is there, I think is frankly absurd. You know, I mean, Americans of all political views and all ages tend to support Medicare and Social Security and believe that they're valuable investments. And Republicans and Governor Romney in particular, who made that statement, you know, even he was not in favor of, you know, cutting Social Security, or he did have a plan to overhaul Medicare, which would have changed the program substantially. But, you know, I think that he would not consider himself the foe of those retired Americans benefiting from those programs.
Well, he didn't communicate that real well during his campaign.
No, he didn't.
If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Matea Kramer of the National Priorities Project, and we're talking about where our taxes really go that we all paid. Well, hopefully we paid April 15th, because you know, that means you're doing okay if you paid taxes. What is the, a lot of people do get angry. People, you know, in the middle and on the left at supporting corporations and bailing out the banks. Bailing out the banks made a lot of people angry. What were the tax ramifications of bailing out the big banks that caused the real problem in the first place.
Well, we did spend hundreds of billions of dollars on the TARP program, the Troubled Asset Relief Program.
Right.
That was back in 2009, 2010. And that absolutely, you know, tax dollars went to bailing out some major corporations in that situation. We have made some of that money back. You know, some banks have paid back in full. Some banks have paid back with interest.
Mm-hmm.
So, taxpayers are not bearing the full cost of the TARP program, but they're certainly bearing some of it. And that absolutely did anger many Americans. I think that was in part what helped to precipitate the Occupy movement.
Yes.
About income inequality and are the political and economic powers that be tilted in favor of those who are the most fortunate.
Yeah, and, you know, back to kind of a general question. I wonder what percentage of the federal pie, the money that comes in on April 15th, or some people have delays, what percent comes from the middle and lower income? Maybe this is, you can't really say numbers-wise, but, you know, taking a look at the current tax structure, there are CEO retirement packages compared with ordinary workers and wealth distribution, you know, that the tax structure seems to support one way or another wealth distribution. You know, a lot of people... you know, Tea Party types see wealth distribution as some sort of socialist plan to, you know, spend a lot of money and just take from the middle and give to the poorest. What is the reality on that?
Well, what's interesting here is that income taxes are only part of the story. Now, we know, of course, that there are many Americans who don't earn enough money to owe any income tax at all, but that does not mean that they're not paying federal taxes. And in fact, income taxes for all individuals, not corporations, but individuals of all income levels, comprise just under half of all federal tax revenue. But our payroll taxes, Social Security and Medicare taxes, comprise about 35%, by far the next largest share after income taxes. And everyone who earns a paycheck, regardless of income level, pays those Social Security and Medicare taxes. No one is exempt, regardless of income level, if you're earning wage income. Now, what's interesting is investment income is exempt from those kinds of taxes. So regardless of where you fall on the income spectrum, including those who are making very, very small amounts of money each year, are paying federal taxes and they're paying substantial shares. There's nearly half of all Americans, it's somewhere in the 40% of all Americans, pay more in payroll taxes than income taxes. So it just depends on how you look at this issue. Essentially, we're all chipping in.
Well, it's good to know that we're all chipping in. I wonder how... Well, frankly, fair it really is. I mean, I think if people felt like, you know, it's fair taxes and that it's going to the things we like to. I had one person on my website saying I would love to pay taxes if my money went to schools, healthcare, infrastructure, social programs, libraries, and other like programming. I hate paying for our many illegal mishaps around the world. It's morally inept. And financial suicide, too. It seems that that has some degree of accuracy to it.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think Americans would have, you know, far greater sense of pride in sending that check to the IRS each April if they had the feeling that their tax dollars were being spent in a way that coincided with their own priorities. And, you know, that's very much what we're about at National Priorities Project.
Right.
First of all, making this information available so Americans can see what the heck is going on in Washington and where our tax dollars are currently going. And then to take the time to think about their own priorities for this country, and if Washington currently isn't measuring up, isn't acting in ways that are consistent with our priorities, then getting involved. And, you know, we place a great deal of emphasis on Americans getting involved in the process, and you know, in particular, being in touch with their elected officials. You know, I think most of us have the sense that we can't make a difference by calling our legislators, that they're not listening. It wouldn't matter if we got in touch anyway. But the reality is that they are paying attention. They are
Absolutely.
Listening. Legislative aides do keep track of constituent sentiment. But most of us never take the time to get in touch with our legislators. And imagine a world in which many more Americans, or all Americans, were in touch with their legislators on a regular basis. I mean, first of all, they would need many more staffers to field all of that constituent input. But I think we would live in a different world.
And it absolutely does make a difference. As a former elected official myself, I can tell you it really makes a difference. So if you're listening, if you've given up power, if you believe, if you've accepted your sense of powerlessness, It isn't true. You really can make a difference. For every one call or email they get, they figure there's probably 100 people who feel the same way. It can make a huge difference. I mean, you can't, I suppose we could just give up and let the corporate lobbyists run everything. But that's not what a republic is supposed to be. And it's not just a pie in the sky. It does work. We have plenty of examples where pressure from the public absolutely works. They know they need to get reelected. You have found, now I find this interesting, that 90% of Americans want a simpler tax code. It's not real simple now. How much of a problem is this really? And can it really be that much more simple and still be fair?
Well, it's a huge problem from the perspective of efficiency. I mean, we're spending many millions of hours and billions of dollars in wasted time in filing our taxes. And I think many people are attuned to this issue. I know I certainly am. I took, my husband and I hours of pulling out our hair to try to figure out how to deal with having purchased a house and renting out a room. It's just nonsense. Why is our tax code so complicated? It is absolutely possible to simplify it. It is within our ability as a country to come up with a tax code that's much simpler, that wastes less time, and still maintains some core values of raising enough revenue to fund the things that we as a country want to fund, meeting some criteria of fairness, and then not creating too much economic distortion, including too much wasting of our time.
Well, I'm sure all those accountants out there don't want to hear such language.
Well, our tax code certainly does create a huge profession of tax preparers. But, that's time and intelligence that could be used for other things.
True.
Coming up with a cure for cancer. I mean, why does all of those all of that brain power have to be used to help people prepare their taxes?
And we're talking about priorities. Oddly enough, this is the National Priorities Project. It's fascinating to me that the priorities of the public, as you've taken the temperature of the public, your organization, they're pretty intelligent, pretty smart. Now, Obama's talking about cutting Social Security. What about Medicare? I find it interesting you call Medicare, quote, the big ugly, unquote. Could you explain that?
Sure, yeah. Not so much Medicare specifically, but healthcare costs. Healthcare costs are, I think many of us experience this in our own lives. They've been rising steadily for many years, and we experience that in the form of premiums or difficulty with health insurance in many different ways, the cost of tests and procedures. Healthcare costs are the key budget challenge for our lawmakers in the future, and the writing is on the wall. I mean, right now, healthcare costs comprise about a quarter of all federal spending. That's not just of your income taxes, but all taxes together. So a quarter of the total federal budget goes to Medicare and other health programs. That's up from about 7% in 1976, which is not so long ago.
Right.
We've seen that percentage rise, creep up each year steadily, even from 2012 to 2013 and now projected for 2014. It just keeps on creeping up. So the big ugly essentially is figuring out how to contain healthcare cost growth. And there are promising proposals out there to discern that very issue. But what is certainly true is that what we're doing right now is not working. And in particular, we have this fee-for-service system in which we essentially punish healthcare providers for investing in preventive or coordinated healthcare, and instead we just pay healthcare providers to run as many tests and procedures as possible. And certainly I think that hardly anyone would argue that that's the way to keep people healthiest.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You point out that the U.S. actually, believe it or not, spends less on government than many other developed nations, but certainly we spend a heck of a lot more for healthcare than other developed nations. So we have to deal
with it. That's right. We spend more money per person and often with the same or lesser healthcare results.
And I want to ask one more thing about specific taxes. The idea of a carbon tax has been discussed. How do people feel about a carbon tax? This has to do with pollution. So that, there's a tremendous amount of carbon that's going up in the air and doing that, melting the polar ice caps, causing the greenhouse effect. It's a fact. But wouldn't a carbon tax have the effect of slowing growth in the economy and jobs? And does it not, a carbon tax, tax people unfairly?
So, a carbon tax, any kind of a tax has a negative impact on the economy, as we were just talking about with income taxes. So the question is, what kind of taxes are we going to have, because we're going to have some kind of tax in order to support the functioning of our government, and how can we design it so that it's the smartest and most efficient as possible. Many economists across the ideological spectrum are in favor of carbon taxes because any kind of tax, whatever activity you tax, you're going to get less of it because that activity is less beneficial. So if we tax carbon, we're going to get less carbon, and that argument applies to taxing wage labor. Economists would say it's, you know, the silliest thing to do to tax wage labor or working because people will work less, and we want people to work more. That's a good thing. So economists say a carbon tax is a smart way to go. We'll get less carbon, and it will make investment in alternative forms of energy more attractive.
But you're thinking long term. How silly. Who the heck thinks long term?
not necessarily Washington.
Oh, that's for sure. And, you know, it's so interesting. You know, the Tea Party people say, and again, they're fading pretty quickly, appropriately. So they talk about a socialist world in which a faceless them confiscates everything we own and seizes every penny we earn. My sense is that, you know, it really is changing, as you say, people get it. They understand that, you know, we need to have taxes, as we opened the show with quoting from Oliver Wendell Holmes, taxes are what we pay for a civilized society. Do you see any hope of what might be considered tax justice, although I don't know how far you think we are from that ideal, any hope that we may be beginning to fight to take, frankly, our democracy back from the moneyed interests that corrupt it in order to pilfer our shared wealth? Is there any hope, any sense? I know this is a little bit beyond your scope of vision, but I'll go for it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have seen some important agitation. You know, and I think the Occupy movement was interesting in that regard. You know, we saw people get together and say, you know, we won't tolerate this level of income inequality. I don't think that right now we have the kind of agitation that fits the description of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I think that the things that it would take to really make meaningful change in this country, for instance, reforming the way that we finance campaigns so that we don't, you know, just elect people who are good fundraisers, but rather elect people who
seems
you
to
know,
be at the base of everything.
Governing.
Yes.
You know, campaign finance reform should not be beyond us. And what it will take, though, is you know, huge movement and support from the people, which I don't think that we've reached that level yet.
Right.
Another important thing might be, you know, drawing congressional districts in a non-political body, you know, so that we don't have gerrymandered congressional districts, but rather districts that
really
just represent population. You know, I think that those kinds of changes would make a huge difference in whether Washington serves certain narrow special interests or serves the people.
It can be done. Well, this has been very, very interesting and very informative. If people want to find out more about the National Priorities Project and the research into where our tax dollars go, I'm suspecting you can point them to something on that old internet.
Oh, boy, can I. I hope folks will go to nationalpriorities.org. There's lots of information there, including exactly where your tax dollars were spent. We'll write you a personalized tax receipt. You can enter how much you paid in federal income taxes and see exactly where that money went. There's lots of other information there, too. We have a book called The People's Guide to the Federal Budget. Lots of resources that hopefully will be very useful to people, and we hope people will get involved.
And again, you can get involved. It doesn't take that much time, and you'd be amazed how much your elected officials really do pay attention to what you're saying. If you just sit there and acquiesce, they think you're going along with it. It can be done. Very interesting, and we'll see where we are, you know, next April 15th as well, see if there's any significant changes. It all depends on the people speaking up and doing, you know, depending on good research like the National Priorities Project. Matea Kramer, thanks so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Texas. Thanks for listening.
Stealing from a boy like me. I've been out working day and night since I was small. I know you gotta take your share, but do you have to take it all? Nickel and dime and me to death, squeezing from me my last breath. Leave me and my friends alone. You're busting up our happy home. A tax collector, there's a change in the weather. Come on.
what you're telling me. If I give you everything, well, can I keep the rest for me? Well, I've got news for you. No, no, that'll never do. I'm tired of paying the bills on some of the things you do. Nickel and diamond me to death, squeezing from me all of my breath. Leave me and my friends alone. You're busting out our happy home. A tax collector, there's a change in the weather. Oh, come on, listen to the weather.
Jonathan Edwards, tax collector.